Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. Hello, I'm Kevin Kelton. I'm a Democrat, and I live in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, I'm Molly Malloy Cooper. I'm a free market conservative from Columbus, Ohio.
Hi there, I'm DJ McGuire, a rather anxious Tory on the wrong side of the Atlantic from Suffolk, Virginia.
I'm Cliff Dunn, a Republican from Newport News, Virginia.
And I'm Rebecca Kushmider. I'm a liberal Democrat from Kensington, Maryland.
And together we make up the More Perfect Union podcast. Well, gang, this has been another one of those weeks where you don't know where to start, but I guess we couldn't start anyplace else but with the James Comey hearing. Now, about 19 million people watched this sucker, and about 8.5 million saw it one way, and 8.5 million saw it the other way. So which way did you guys see it? Who wants to go first?
Comey chameleon.
Salute, Cliff.
Oh, my gosh. Where to begin? So many things. But I have been trying to figure him out for months. Really going back to last July. And then, of course, November and then May and now June. And I used to think once upon a time that he was apolitical outside the realm of politics. But now I totally can dispense with that notion, you know, given the fact that he has a mechanism and knows how to leak and who to leak to. So I guess he's definitely crossed that bridge and is in fact very political. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, was starting to suspect that, but now I am not. I give him credit for having to be, because it seems like he's had a lot of shenanigans from both sides of the aisle, from both the Trump administration and from not Obama himself, but from Loretta Lynch. So, you know, he's done what he thought he needed to do. So that's kind of where I am with Comey.
So what you're saying is you see him in sympathetic terms.
I do.
I think that his politics, he's in the FBI's party. He seems to hold the FBI above all else, and his goal is to make the FBI come out looking as blameless as possible in anything, which is admirable in its way.
Well, you know, again, very put upon. Now there's all kinds of things out there about, you know, queasiness and nauseous I'm starting to wonder about some kind of a Pepto-Bismol endorsement for him.
I first of all, this week I learned that it turns out that James Comey and I, 35 years or so apart, wrote for the same school paper. He actually wrote for the Flat Hat, and I did as well. That aside, the feeling I get is he spends a lot of time being nauseous, and the nausea thing is getting overplayed a bit by him, actually. He always seems to be nauseous. I'm not sure what he was expecting when he went into Washington. Probably wasn't what actually came out. But no, I can say he seems to have tried to do the best he could under trying circumstances. That being said, it's turned him almost into a human weather vane in respect to who he's yelling at this week. You know, he was nauseous about the Clinton thing. He was being yelled at to do this, that, and other back last summer. Now he's nauseous about Trump, and the act is getting a little bit old. And to be fair, I don't think it's an act in the sense of he's faking it, but it's hearing the same thing over and over from him is getting old.
You know, I think to some extent, Comey is a lot like the millions of Americans who really did not want to have to choose between these two choices for president. The only difference is he actually has some power to be able to do something about it. And that's what makes him special. And now we have essentially millions of Americans who are hoping that he could do what they cannot, which is essentially knock Donald Trump out of the White House. I don't think Comey will be able to do that. Number one, witnesses can't do that. I think it is a matter of he was doing what he thought was right in a town where what you think is right is not always what is right. Because there is your own personal opinion. There is the opinion of the institution for which you work. And there is what is in the best interest of the country. And what's in the best interest of the country may not necessarily be what's in the best interest of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I'm not saying that's what happened this time. But I am saying that he was the typical Washington bureaucrat in all its glory and in all its horror.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Now, there's several elements to his testimony. Let's start with the statement that he released the day before, the opening statement, in which he laid out the meetings that he had with President Trump, what transpired according to James Comey, and the apparent obstruction of justice charges.
First of all, I want to comment that I wish I could write that concisely and that clearly. He put so much information into these incredibly clean sentences and paragraphs. One of the Republicans, and I can't remember which one now, actually commented on Comey seems to be an expert in legal writing. And I would have to agree. I found reading the seven pages really pleasurable from a literary standpoint. It seems like he endeavored really hard not to speculate in his written testimony. He was attempting to lay out a series of events as he remembered them, drawing from notes he made contemporaneously, and, you know, was telling his side of the story. And there were people who commented, and I got this sense when I was reading that and also when I was listening to the questioning, that this was almost like a sexual assault victim trying to detail their version of events. And he was doing it in this one venue, the written word, where nobody could say, yeah, but what about? What were you wearing? Are you sure you weren't asking for it? Were you drunk? You know, to draw on kind of stereotypical questions asked of sexual assault victims. And he worked really hard to put his version of events out there in a way that couldn't be questioned. And it served its purpose, to my thinking.
You know, I think Rebecca hit on it's very concise and well written. He did a good job of highlighting points where it sounds like they're both telling the truth from their perspective and their understanding of events is slightly different. I think all parties concerned are saying what they understand to be true about it, but they have different understandings, recollections, et cetera, of what happened. And I think he did a pretty good job of highlighting that.
And Molly, what about you? You're a college professor of economics. Your students often have to write papers that you grade. What would you grade the director of the FBI, or I should say the former director of the FBI, on his narrative style and syntax?
No, I'll agree with Rebecca. His writing is definitely much cleaner and neater and concise than what I usually see.
So a B plus on style.
But in taking this all together, the first part, his opening statement as to why he was fired and whether it's obstruction of justice, two things. I'll start with whether it's obstruction of justice. I think regardless of who's correct, if there were to be tapes, I don't think there are tapes, I'll go ahead and say that, but if there were to be tapes,
Wait, you mean Trump is lying about the tapes? Come on.
And Lordy, he hopes there are.
Lordy.
So even if there were tapes that, you know, that he was right, you know, word for word, he went home, he wrote this memo, he you know, has a great memory. Even if he were correct, I don't think you get to obstruction of justice based on his recollection of this. I hope you can see your way clear. I don't. And I mean, paired with him wanting to other statements that were attributed to Trump by Comey about continuing the investigation, about wanting to know if there were other satellites, I believe was the word that were involved in this. So I don't think you get to obstruction of justice. And I read a piece this morning by David Brooks that was arguing pretty much that he was not fired for Flynn, but that Trump fired him for refusing to go public with the fact that Trump himself was not under investigation. And that is my belief at this point as well, after this testimony.
Okay, so I guess the question becomes at this point, you know, what do you take away from it? Is there an indictable offense there? And I think the mistake that a lot of people are making is They're looking at what they know to be the facts as of today, not what the FBI may know that we don't know, or what facts or what fact patterns may develop between now and the end of Robert Mueller's investigation. So I think a lot of people are jumping to conclusions because they think they know everything that there is to be known about this case. And I think in reality, the investigation is just beginning. I mean, Mueller is just hiring staff right now, but by the time they finished interviewing witnesses, putting the puzzle pieces together, interconnecting all of the facts that they will uncover, I think this is going to be a very different case than what it looks like to us on the outside today. And, you know, there won't be an indictment because it doesn't seem like you can indict a sitting president, but it very well may lead to articles of impeachment in the right House of Representatives, not the 2017 House, but maybe in the 2019 House.
Well, Kevin, I just want to say that this feels, your comments, remind me of the old joke about being able to indict a ham sandwich in front of the right grand jury. Yes, if you got in front of the right grand jury, you could probably generate something. Whether there's something that would actually go to trial with a reasonable chance of success in a non-politicized court, the Senate is definitely a politicized court. I think we would all agree to that. But whether you could actually go in front of a non-political court and hope to get anything resembling a conviction out of this, I don't see that.
Yeah, I think in terms of whether or not you can get 218 eyes for impeachment in this House of Representatives, I would have to say no. I think the bigger issue is I have phrased it this way. I think the bigger problem is that we have, again, focused too much on the legal arguments and not enough on the political arguments. I'm not saying ignore the legal arguments. I'm saying walk and chew gum at the same time. Richard Nixon was brought down by Watergate because people did not like the fact that the president of the United States was essentially involved in nonstop political espionage against the opposition. They did not like that. Bill Clinton survived the Whitewater investigation because Republicans did not explain to the American people that deep down this was about a governor of Arkansas using his power to essentially bankrupt a savings and loan and bail his partner out with $50 million of federal taxpayers' money without anyone suffering any consequences for it. That message was never really conveyed to the American people. In any event, Democrats and Trump critics need to focus more on the policy implications of this, the danger of Trump's allegiance with Vladimir Putin, the danger of appeasing a man who is helping Bashar Assad kill millions of Syrians, the danger of appeasing a man who is scaring just about every country between Germany and Belarus, the danger of appeasing a man who has no concern for human rights as we understand them. If the American people look and they go, okay, we're dealing with a president who got elected because Vladimir Putin thought that he would no longer feel any pressure to essentially run roughshod over every democratic human rights and international norm in the book, then the American people won't care whether it's illegal. They will be angry enough to want him removed from office at the earliest opportunity. That may be 2020. That may, by some strange, weird luck, be earlier. That doesn't matter. The end game is making clear that the American people recognize the danger of Trump's policy and that this sort of issue and this issue regarding Michael Flynn and others is about what Trump is doing now still, even if it is legal, not about what may or may not be illegal, depending on which lawyer you stumble into one day.
Fair point.
Well, I think that one thing that Comey made abundantly clear is that the Russian interference in the election is a real thing. And I wish I could remember the technical term he used, the intrusion or something like that. It's a real thing. It's ongoing. It's going to happen again as soon as 2018, if not sooner. Mark Warner mentioned that there's a Virginia election going on right now. And I think Comey feels a sense of great urgency to make that stop. And he talked about people within the Trump camp being compromised, not them being actual actors in terms of conscious and premeditated malfeasance, but as potentially being people that the Russians could use wittingly or unwittingly in their continued efforts to undermine our systems. And I think that was actually a message that was getting a little bit lost as we sat there talking about, well, did Trump commit obstruction of justice or not? That may not matter in the end, because if Vladimir Putin is, you know, worming his way under the surface of our entire electoral system, a little obstruction of justice is just some icing on the really shitty cake.
Which is a great segue to the other big revelation that came out of the Comey hearing, and apparently even more so in the closed door session that happened later that day. Apparently, he spoke to the fact that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, had yet another meeting with some Russian power broker that was not revealed previously to the Senate or the congressional investigators. And this is creating now a lot of problems for Jeff Sessions, who, by the way, will be testifying apparently this week. I'm not sure whether it's in open session or closed session. Obviously, there's a lot of sessions in that sentence. But he's going to be speaking again about his meetings with the Russians, and he may be the one that comes out of the Comey hearing in the most hot water. What do you guys think?
It's going to be fascinating. If it is in closed session, I would love to be a fly on that wall, because I feel like, you know, Sessions is already walking a tightrope, because there are some people who think he perjured himself in his confirmation hearings. And, you know, there were a lot of questions in the Comey hearing about why didn't you go to Sessions? And Comey said, actually, rather explicitly, I didn't go to him because I thought he was about to recuse himself. He turned out he did recuse himself, and there were other reasons. And I think the committee wants to hear about those other reasons. They probably heard in the closed session with Comey, and I think they want to address them with Sessions. Is Sessions willing to perjure himself, to defend Trump? I'm not sure at this point. Comey really cast a shadow over that guy.
Yeah, I would say I'm rather fascinated by this, if only because with everybody else who has, shall we say, been alleged of at least fumbling around in politics lately, you can make the novice case, you know, Kushner, Trump, et cetera. Sessions was in the Senate for, what, 30 years almost? I am impressed at how badly he fumbled this as quickly as he did, that he's even under this shadow.
He was also an attorney general of a state, wasn't he? And he was up for a federal judgeship. The guy was a federal prosecutor. He is a career politician. He should know better than to mess up.
Yeah, he was a United States senator for 20 years. He should know the way Washington works.
And speaking of how Washington works, the House did something this week that this day and age shouldn't surprise anyone. While everybody was looking at the shiny object of the Senate Comey hearing, the House of Representatives, when no one was looking, went ahead and defanged Dodd-Frank. They couldn't wait to kill this bill, and what they've done is they've taken a step towards killing it by taking the teeth out of several of its provisions. Anybody want to take a shot at explaining what happened there?
I'll take a shot. So, you know, I think that Dodd-Frank is not working as often in a lot of regulations are as intended. As of right now, we have the five largest banks now hold 40% of assets. We are way too concentrated. And that is because the regulatory burdens of Dodd-Frank disproportionately cannot be borne by the smaller, more responsive community banks, which are good for small businesses. And we have, really the big banks that can absorb these costs thriving, and the smaller guys are getting edged out. Prior to Dodd-Frank, we were averaging about 100 new banks a year. From 2010 to 2013, according to a report by, I believe it was the Richmond Fed, there were only four new banks in that time span. So this is having a chilling effect on the formation of new, smaller, more responsive community banks. And if you worry about, you know, the Dodd-Frank was passed and everybody says, you know, this is who champions it. The Democrats say, this is us taking on Wall Street. No, this is you really harming Main Street as a unintended consequence. And so I am not unhappy with legislation that is picking apart Dodd-Frank.
I'm going to make a confession here. Barney Frank's book, Frank, was one of my favorite political memoirs of all time, but I literally skipped the chapter on Dodd-Frank because the moment Barney Frank started talking about financial services, my eyes crossed and I can't understand any of it. It's completely outside of my areas of policy interest. The question I would ask Molly, and I don't actually know enough about what the House bill does to even speak intelligently about this, is does Dodd-Frank need to be dismantled? Do we need to burn it down? Or is this something that we could go in for a reauth process, tweak, open some new channels for new banks to form, and do it by increments, not by total destruction?
There was a proposed kind of, I think, before this Financial Choice Act, which is what was passed by the House this week, got passed, that did some tweaks that I guess had some potential that would change the requirements for banks that were smaller. And that would be a good compromise. But really, just in general, what I think is it's all missing what is the true problem with our financial system, which is too big to fail. And we have to get rid of too big to fail. And that is, again, something that benefits these large banks. And so it would not be necessary if we would let the big banks fail.
Okay, well, I knew that the conservative economist was going to be in favor of what the House did, but that's okay. That's okay. Let's find out how other people here think. Anybody else have an opinion, whether it's pro or con, for what the House is trying to do with Dodd-Frank?
I do. I think, first of all, the idea, the 30-year vet state, the United States Senate from Connecticut, which Chris Dodd was, would do anything to make Wall Street uncomfortable is utterly laughable. And thus we have Dodd-Frank. It was designed to create a regulatory scheme that only larger banks could navigate through, and they have navigated through it. It does essentially ensconce too big to fail in statutory law where it should not be. It applies all the wrong lessons from the panic of 2008. And so I am quite pleased to see that among the things the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau can out of the remit of the Fed, where it could be essentially accountable to nobody, and once again be accountable to the American people through their elected officials.
because who knows more about banking than our elected officials? But okay, that's just me being a wise guy. Cliff, what do you have to say on the matter?
Yeah, I'll say I broadly agree with the early stuff DJ said. I think that there's a real issue with turning around and letting these banks fail, but I think there should be lower caps on size. You know, they don't want any bank right now being over about 10% of deposits. I'd like to see that cut back to 4 or 5%. I'd like to see a lot of pressure for these larger banks to split up. And I would prefer to see the investment bank / depository bank wall re-erected, the old Glass-Steagall division.
Yeah, well, a lot of us would like to see Glass-Steagall brought back in some form or fashion, but that's an entirely different discussion. Let's stay on what happened this week with the Dodd-Frank bill in the House. Rebecca, do you have any thoughts on what happened with Dodd-Frank this week?
I know some gossip about Christopher Dodd.
Gossip? Oh, yes, absolutely.
My Chris Dodd gossip is actually fairly well known. He dated Carrie Fisher at one point.
Who did?
Chris Dodd. Senator Dodd dated Carrie Fisher. But there's a sensational chapter in one of her memoirs where she talks about going on, I think it was her first date with Chris Dodd, which was a double date with Ted Kennedy and whoever he was dating at the time. And Ted Kennedy
okay,
behaved.
Okay, that's just terrifying. I hope Ted didn't drive.
He did not, at least as far as he did not drive Carrie Fisher anywhere. You notice she lived many years after this. Seriously, in her book, I believe it's Wishful Drinking. It might be Shockaholic, but in one of those books, she has an entire chapter about this double date with Chris Dodd and Ted Kennedy and his girlfriend, where Ted Kennedy behaves like a complete and utter Ted Kennedy. And she refuses to back down. It's awesome. I highly recommend reading it. Very funny stuff.
Another quality book recommendation from the More Perfect Union Podcast. So thank you for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at MPU Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/More Perfect Union Podcast. And also, if you like debating politics as much as we do, please join us in our political debate group on Facebook. It's called Open Fire Politics. We're all there, and we'd love to see you there, too. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.